Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, mine website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or at Banking Day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from our website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 3 in our series for 2024, and today's date is Friday, February the 16th. First, I'll be talking to Nina Webster, the Managing Director of Dimerix, a clinical-stage biopharmaceutical company with a portfolio of drug candidates for inflammatory diseases including kidney and respiratory diseases. And I'll be talking to CommSec Chief Economist Craig James about what's in the market for the week ahead. But first, let's talk to Nina Webster.
Well, Nina, tell us about Dimerix.
Absolutely. So Dimerix is a clinical-stage biopharmaceutical company. We have a portfolio of drug candidates in inflammatory diseases, including kidney and respiratory disease. Our lead asset is a compound called DMX-200, and that's in phase 3 clinical trials for a treatment for focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, which is a rare type of kidney disease, as well as our drug candidate DMX-700 in development for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And both of these were identified using our proprietary platform technology called Receptor Hit.
Now, tell us about FSGS. Who does it affect?
So FSGS is a rare disease. It's called an orphan indication, and it affects children as young as 2 years old as well as adults. Sadly, the prognosis is very poor for these patients because there's no drug approved anywhere in the world. And unfortunately, kidney failure is typically within about 5 years of diagnosis. For those fortunate enough to get a transplant, around 60% of those get reoccurring FSGS in the transplanted kidney. So again, the prognosis is very poor and very much in need for a treatment such as DMX-200.
Transplant does not work as well.
That's right. And nobody knows why. That's the sad thing. There's some circulating factor that in the transplanted kidney, it is also impacted.
So tell us about the work that has gone into this.
Yeah, so we've been founded in 2004. We've been working on the DMX-200 asset since about 2012. So it's been about 10 years into development, which from a biotech pharmaceutical perspective is actually a short period of time. And we're in what's called a phase 3 clinical trial, which is the last trial before going to market. This trial is open globally. It's in 11 different countries in 70 clinical sites at the moment recruiting these FSGS patients. To 2024, we would expect to see the second interim outcome from this study. And if successful, we can then submit for marketing approval at that point in time because it is a rare disease.
So it won't actually get onto the market till 2025?
Expected to be on the market around 2025, that is correct.
That's quite extraordinary because you set up in 2012, did you say?
2012 is when we started on this asset, but typically development in biopharmaceutical is around 10 to 15 years of development. So if you're looking at a phase one asset, they're probably around 10 to 15 years away from market. We're in that final stage, so we're within the 2 years.
So anyone who sets up a business in biotech needs a hell of a lot of patience.
That's exactly right. It's a very different portfolio to invest in as well versus resources.
Is that an issue for you in terms of attracting investors to that because of that long time frame?
Not particularly. I think you have a particular investor who has the appetite for investment into biotech. Biotech, when we get success, typically success is very big. And therefore, whilst the risk is potentially higher, the reward is also a magnitude higher.
Tell us about the firm itself. How many do you have working for you?
So we're a company of about 12 employees at the moment, so it's relatively small. We have each of those core functions within that, very, very skilled, capable employees across our clinical, regulatory, manufacturing, intellectual property areas. Each of our team members is very experienced in drug development, has taken products from inception right through to marketing approval in the past. So a very, very good team to deliver on this program.
And you're all based in Melbourne, is that right?
We are all based in Melbourne at the moment, yes.
Now, tell us about the actual effect on children itself. So you say it affects children as young as two?
That's right. So when a patient presents with a kidney disease, often they'll have accompanying edema. So there's a lot of swelling in the tissues, a yellowing of the skin. They can be quite unwell, and they typically have what's called protein in the urine. So very high protein spills into the urine. What happens is in a healthy person, a healthy child or a healthy adult, the kidney is a really, really good filter, and it effectively filters out all protein from the blood. What happens in as the kidney becomes more and more damaged, it becomes quite leaky. And so you end up with this protein spilling into the urine and end up with this very high urinary infection, high urine protein content as well.
What causes it?
Well, FSGS, the predominant cause is unknown. And that's one of the challenges because, as I mentioned before, those who end up with a kidney transplant, around 60% get reoccurring FSGS in the transplanted kidney. And nobody knows why.
Really?
Yeah, it's very, very poor prognosis for these patients. And with no effective treatment anywhere in the world at the moment, no treatment approved for FSGS, it is a big unmet need. So if DMX-200 is successful in this clinical trial, there is certainly a very, very big market potential for this drug.
But how difficult would it be to prepare DMX-200 when you don't really have an idea of why the disease is occurring?
What we're treating, though, is that inflammatory pathway. So if we think about the three key mechanisms in kidney disease, the first one is this hypertension, hyperfiltration. So you imagine the blood vessels in the kidney are working really, really hard, and that causes inflammation. Now, that inflammation is ongoing and persistent, so it causes fibrosis, which is a type of scarring, and you lose those cells.
Yep.
As those cells die off, they cannot regenerate in the kidney. Unfortunately, it's a progressive disease, and you end up at that point number one, where now the blood vessels, there's less cells, have to work even harder. So now that causes more inflammation, causes more cell death. And you can imagine in this cycle, you go round and round faster and faster as you have fewer and fewer cells, until you get to a point where there are not enough cells to effectively filter the blood and your kidney fails.
So basically, though, your medication would be treating the symptoms rather than the cause of it. Would that
be
right?
It's treating that inflammatory pathway. So it reduces the inflammation. And what it does is by reducing the inflammation, it reduces the fibrosis or scarring. So you maintain those cells. So instead of coming down your kidney disease slope here, you're going to try and keep it as flat as you can and maintain your kidney function.
That would take an extraordinary discipline of research, wouldn't it?
It does. And it's amazing, actually, when you think about that inflammatory pathway. I mentioned at the start, we focus on inflammatory diseases. One of those is kidney disease and, of course, respiratory disease. That principle of inflammation is implicated in a raft of other diseases as well. So the inflammatory pathway has a high implication in a number of diseases.
Which could make DMX-200 quite exciting because it could actually be used to treat other diseases. Would that be right?
That has the potential to do that, absolutely. So DMX-200 is what is called a CCR2 antagonist. And so it actually does turn off the response for the inflammation.
But it could potentially treat other diseases.
Correct, yes.
So it could have much broader implications than just kidney disease.
Yes, CCR2 has been implicated in a whole raft of diseases, all from the inflammatory background and cause. Kidney disease is the first one we're going for. Focal segmental glomerulosclerosis is that rare disease. And the reason that that is so attractive to us in the first instance, because it's an orphan disease, it means that we have a faster pathway to market. We get an accelerated review period, and we also get what's called orphan drug pricing. Now, because there are fewer patients that have the disease, there has to be an incentive for companies to develop the drug. Otherwise, there's no market, there's no commercial need for the company to do this. So they get what's called orphan drug pricing, and orphan drug pricing is usually a lot higher. The average orphan drug in the US retails at $7,000 per month. Now, that's the average, and there are some that will be up at 100,000 and there'll be some down that are lower. But that gives you a sense of these drugs retail at a much higher price because otherwise there's no incentive for a company to do it. But with the orphan drug pricing, the accelerated pathway to market, so we can go for accelerated drug approval, as well as the what we get is orphan exclusivity. That means that if we get the product to market, it cannot be challenged by a generic for 10 years in Europe and 7 years in the US. So it's a very valuable exclusivity period that nobody else can enter the market.
And you would be the only company developing this kind of drug?
So we're the only company developing a CCR2 antagonist. In terms of FSGS, there is one other company developing a phase 3 compound at the moment. Conveniently for us, it's actually very complementary to us. It's not competitive at all. And in fact, they've got approval for a different indication, not FSGS at the moment, and they have priced theirs at $9,900 per month. So it tells you it's a very attractive market.
Absolutely. At that sort of price. Yes. Well, Nina, it's been a privilege talking to you. And thank you very much for your time and good luck.
Thank you so much, Leon. Really appreciate your time.
And now let's talk to CommSec Chief Economist, Craig James.
Okay, Craig, what's in store for the market in the week ahead?
It's going to be a fairly quiet affair. We haven't got too many market-leading indicators coming out. Consumer sentiment, that always comes out. The weekly measure always comes out on the Tuesday from ANZ and Roy Morgan. It's got a measure of inflation expectations. So in the current environment, that's quite important to be able to see how they're tracking. The two major events in the coming week is on Tuesday, the minutes of the last Reserve Bank board meeting. And remembering that there was a two-day meeting for the first time that we've seen it this year. And the wage price index is coming out on Wednesday. So the main measure of wages in Australia. Wages are currently growing near 4%, and that will be very much in focus. The tail end of the week, we've got the Flash Purchasing Managers Index coming out on Thursday, together with average weekly earnings, and also some more detail in terms of the labour force getting into the demographic and the regional data. So a fairly quiet week in Australia. In the United States, we've got minutes of the last Federal Reserve meeting, so similar to Australia. We've got that coming out on Wednesday. Then the tail end of the week, we've got things like the Flash Purchasing Managers Index, as we do in Australia, coming out on Thursday, and existing home sales on Friday. But the other major focus in the coming week is the profit reporting season that will be in full swing. We've got some heavyweight companies that will be reporting over the coming week, including BHP, Rio Tinto, Fortescue, Domino's Pizza and Woolworths. So really the who's who of corporate Australia. And so far what we've seen in terms of the profit reporting season has been quite encouraging. Companies have seen their share price increase on the day of the report. And generally, yes, the profits are meeting or beating expectations. So that's has analysts somewhat scratching their heads because we're seeing so many companies talking about complications and challenges in the economic environment. But what we're seeing in terms of the companies is that they're actually holding up quite well. So the two themes from the last profit reporting season, challenging conditions, but the resilience of the economy and companies are very much showing through. As I say, you know, sort of if we're thinking of economic data, though, it's those wage figures coming out on Wednesday.
What are the wage figures going to show?
Well, the expectation of Bloomberg, yes, the survey of Bloomberg, yes, of economists, believe that the annual rate will be somewhere between 4 and 4.3%. So we've got wages at the moment growing at a 4% annual pace, which would be okay if in the normal world, if you had productivity growth growing 1 to 1.5%. The ready reckoner is that if you want the midpoint of the inflation targeting band, 2.5%, what you need to have is productivity growing somewhere around about 1 to 1.5% to justify something up around about 4% for wages. So at the moment, we're a little bit on the top side for that. And what we really need to see, you know, sort of is productivity starting to improve. And I think that will come. We've got to remember that we've seen some very strong job growth over the last couple of years, and it takes time for people getting a new job, getting into their the procedures in the new job, and and getting their productivity up a little bit. I think it will come, but so this is something which the Reserve Bank is very much focused on, the fact that wages at 4% with zero productivity are growing slightly above where they want inflation to be at 2.5%.
Right. Okay. And what does that mean for rates for the RBA in terms of?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if we see wages continue to hold up prices, then what we see is the Reserve Bank remaining on the sideline for a longer period of time. Now, the current expectation in terms of economists is that, and the financial market more generally, is that we start to see interest rates coming through, perhaps August, perhaps September. Certainly the Commonwealth Bank Group view is that we'll see the first interest rate cut in September. We think by that time it'll show sufficient slowdown in the economy, sufficient slowing in terms of inflation as well, or the disinflation coming through. And then once we get to through to September, the expectation is that the underlying rate of inflation will be back in the target band either late this year or early next year. So that's a little bit above the forecast for the Reserve Bank. Reserve Bank doesn't believe that we'll be sustainably in the 2-3% target band until probably 2026. But I think they're playing that safety first this time. I don't want to get into the same trouble that they got in a few years ago when Phil Lowe predicted that interest rates wouldn't need to change. And of course, that turned out to be not the case, that interest rates went up. So I think they're being a little bit cautious about when the first interest rate reduction will start to occur. But very much when you're thinking about interest rates, you're thinking about inflation, you're thinking about wages. And that's why the wage data on Wednesday and the average weekly earnings on Thursday are going to be super important.
Right. Okay. And what do you make of the profit reporting season generally at the moment? I mean, there's been some pretty good challenges there.
Yeah, no, it's been quite interesting so far. The majority of companies so far have seen their share price rise on the day after the profit announced, profit being announced. That suggests that companies are either meeting or beating expectations with either some or all of the metrics. Of course, so we look at things like revenue, profitability, as well as looking at things like dividend payments and looking at the definitive outlook statements that are coming out from companies. It's a similar sort of environment that we saw probably 6 months ago, when companies were saying these are challenging times that we're in, and then highlighting the fact that they're doing okay. So I think what we are seeing is companies making sure that their expenses constrained. They're running a tight ship, that's being reflected in the fact that earnings are growing at a modest level, but still enough to exceed the expenses or cost of sales and profits, holding up quite nicely. I think what we are seeing is that while companies are paying dividends, still keen to pay dividends, they are generally smaller than what we saw 12 months ago.
Right. Okay. Which surprisingly though, the share prices have increased.
Yeah, I think it's the fact that companies are being shown to be fairly responsible about keeping their house in order. We do know the economy has slowed. We do know that businesses and consumers are slowing down their rate of spending. The economy is probably ground to somewhat of a halt at the moment. We're thinking GDP for the or economic growth for the December quarter that we've just been in will be close to zero. So flat economy. We've got an unemployment rate starting to creep up a little bit as well. We think that will show up down the track as further signs of disinflation in the economy. Further moderation, you sort of wage growth. But the disinflation certainly is happening at a goods level. What is very much a common feature around the world is the fact that services inflation remains a little bit on the high side. And that's where central banks, including our own here in Australia, would like to see a bit further progress in terms of getting that services inflation down. And that's things like cafes and restaurants, insurance or financial services, hairdressing services, vets, you know, sort of a whole range.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Activities, you know, sort of fall under that services umbrella.
Right, okay. And so all of that would be relevant to whether the RBA cuts interest rates, or if they've warned that not to be surprised if we can see an increase in.
I suppose you can never rule it out. And yes, what the Reserve Bank is trying to do is put its foot on inflationary expectations. Doesn't want to get those, you know, sort of starting to rise again. Of course, if you want to get inflation down to 2 to 3%, you've got to have people believing that inflation is going to get down to 2 to 3%. And that's the bottom line. If that's not the case, and we see inflation remaining stubbornly high above the 2 to 3% target band, then the Reserve Bank will say, look, we've got no alternative. We're going to have to increase rates again because, you know, so we still haven't, you know, so got to our goal, or haven't got to our goal as quickly as what we need to prevent inflation expectations starting to be cemented at a higher level.
It's been great talking to you, and thank you very much for your time.
Not a problem at all.
So what's happening in the news? Well, at least 150 Australian taxation office officials have been investigated over a far-reaching GST fraud scheme, with 12 terminated or facing criminal prosecution. The extraordinary figures was revealed in an Auditor General's report that found the ATO's management and oversight of fraud control arrangements for GST is lacking, while its internal risk framework is not fit for purpose. Outside the ATO, at least 100 arrests have taken place, and so far at least 16 people have received criminal conviction. Authorities estimate there have been more than 57,000 perpetrators of a TikTok GST fraud scheme promoted on the popular social media app as a way to get a loan from the government. Individuals register a fake business, get an ABN, register for GST, and then immediately file a business activity statement claiming credit for previous but not legitimate GST payments. Despite more than $81 billion in GST collections every year, this week's Auditor General's report warned oversight and reporting of GST fraud within the ATO is only partly effective, as internal roles and responsibilities are not clear. An ATO spokeswoman said the majority of the 150 officials were former contractors or former employees and were not working with the ATO at the time of suspected fraud. Some were found to be victims of identity theft. Action has been taken against 12 people who were substantiated as having committed the fraud while working at the ATO. More than 4,700 tip-offs related to GST fraud have been received by the ATO since 2019-20. Penalties of more than $120 million were issued before June 30 last year, with interest of about $220 million and continuing to accrue. As of August 31, the ATO said it had recovered $123 million, including $67.6 million recovered via bank garnishee notices. The fraud was uncovered by Westpac and other banks, some of which passed on a series of alerts to the ATO from 2020. But after being frustrated by the apparent lack of action by the ATO, some bank staff shared their concerns informally with the Reserve Bank, which then alerted Treasury and the Tax Office in February last year. Accountants in Western Sydney, where the fraud went viral in mid-2021, have found new examples in recent tax returns, suggesting that the fraud activity is continuing. The ATO agreed to 5 recommendations from the Auditor General and has established a Fraud and Criminal Behaviours Unit to focus on further protecting against fraud. In a statement, the ATO said it takes all fraud attempts seriously and will work with the task force and other agencies to go after individuals suspected of doing the wrong thing. And Sydney's eye-watering house prices are driving an exodus of young families, and a failure to reverse the trend could see Australia's harbour city become known as a place with no grandchildren, the New South Wales State Productivity Commissioner warned. Between 2016 and 2021, Sydney lost twice as many people in the 30 to 40 year age group as it gained, highlighting the need for increasing housing density, Peter Achsetrat said in a video on Tuesday accompanying a new Productivity Commission report. Many young families are leaving Sydney because they can't afford to buy a home, or they can only afford one in the outer suburb with a long commute, Achsetrat said as he launched the report titled What We Gain by Building More Homes in the Right Places. Australia is one of the least affordable countries in the world for housing as a combination of strong population growth, limited construction, and a trend towards smaller households produces a massive shortfall of dwellings. The problem is exacerbated in Sydney, where there's strong opposition to high apartment blocks among local residents. That's at a time when rebound in immigration means that more than 1 million net arrivals in Australia over the next 5 years will need somewhere to live. Migrants tend to congregate in major cities like Sydney. Compared to global counterparts such as London, New York or Paris, Sydney has lower density inner city suburbs, which means there's ample room to grow upwards, the report showed. Achsetrat said he hoped to help shift Sydneysiders' mentality from not in my backyard to appropriate density in my backyard. The report found that Sydney would have generated 45,000 additional dwellings without any extra land if buildings constructed between 2017 and 2022 had been an average of 10 stories high instead of 7. This would have seen prices and rent 5.5% lower, leading to an annual saving of $1,800 for renters, Achsetrat said. We know from overseas that density done well provides benefits for households, communities and the economy, Achsetrat said. I'm confident we can make density work for us. Achsetrat also said it was time for a fresh discussion on heritage restrictions on housing close to the central business district. He pointed to the proliferation of heritage conservation areas, HCAs, that limit new housing, affecting more than half of residential land in prime Sydney suburbs. This reduces the amount available for new housing near the city. We can preserve the gems of Sydney's heritage without inadvertently freezing young people out, Achsetrat said. And Communications Minister Michelle Rowland says X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, could face huge fines when new laws are introduced this year for failing to prevent mis- and disinformation. Citing a litany of recent issues, including the spread of Taylor Swift deepfake pornography, reinstating 6,000 banned accounts and being sued in the federal court over failing to comply with basic safety expectations relating to child exploitation material, Ms. Rowland said it was clear X would face big trouble if the platform continued as it had. Last year, the Albanese government released draft laws that would guarantee new powers to the Australian Communications and Media Authority to combat mis- and disinformation online. Key to the laws is the creation of an industry-generated code of conduct for platforms and additional powers for ACMA to impose strict standards if it decides a code is not stopping mis- and disinformation. In November last year, X was ejected from the industry code for a serious breach, refusing to cooperate with the industry peak body, DIGI, and failing to undertake remedial action. The complaint related to X removing the ability of its users to report content that violated its civic integrity policy. The ejection came just weeks after the eSafety Commission launched federal court action against the company for allegedly failing to truthfully and accurately provide information to certain questions in the notice, which itself came after the commission fined X $610,500 for failing to comply with the reporting notice. X has not paid the fine and has sought judicial review. Under Ms. Rowland's proposed mis- and disinformation laws, if X refuses to cooperate with an ACMA inquiry or comply with a code of conduct registered under the Act, it could face fines of up to $3 million or 2% of annual turnover. If it fails to comply with the ACMA standards, the penalty could be greater of $7.8 million or 5% of the platform's annual turnover. And the boom in property construction during the pandemic has led to a booming market for disputes as developers, builders and funders battle over big-ticket projects gone wrong. Litigation funders are moving to target this growing area, with ASX-listed Omni Bridgeway muscling in on the scene as all sides clamour for funding to bankroll the costly disputes. Omni Bridgeway also has its eye on a ballooning number of renewable energy projects under construction, with many triggering disputes as complex jobs face cost overruns or disputes between contractors. Law firms are also gearing up for more disputes following several high-profile property collapses and a long list of troubled projects gone wrong as cost overrun or build quality disputes land in the courts. Omni Bridgeway investment manager Mitchell Demas said construction companies often face the question of which of their many disputes were worth fighting. In-house legal and contract management teams are often not adequately resourced to assess claims, and as a consequence, claims are not pursued or they are settled at well below their fair value, he said. At its recent results, Omni Bridgeway revealed it committed more than $260 million in the first half of 2024 financial year to new disputes, with a strong pipeline of new investment opportunities. Omni Bridgeway has been funding construction disputes in Britain, Singapore and Dubai for some time, with Australia's high-rise and major project boom a catalyst for the funders' attention. Baker McKenzie National Head of Construction Emmanuel Comfos said the construction sector was facing a confluence of pressure point factors, resulting in an increase in construction disputes. In particular, we're seeing a shortage of both materials and labour, combined with a record investment in the infrastructure space, leading to price increases at levels that are historically high, he said. Baker McKenzie National Construction Practice Senior Partner Harriet Oldmeadow said while owners, developers and contractors want a harmonious working relationship, disputes often descended into protracted fights. And senators say they have no confidence and are worried about PwC's ethical practices as it continues to withhold a global report on its misuse of government information from the inquiry into consulting services. PwC Australia CEO Kevin Burrows told the Finance and Public Administration Committee on Friday that PwC International had refused to share the document which detailed findings from an independent review finalised in September. Senator Richard Colbeck, who chairs the inquiry, said the lack of transparency undermined the firm's efforts to right its wrongs and the aftermath of a tax leak scandal. I can't in any good conscience acknowledge that I have confidence that when your organisation, and you are part of that organisation, is thumbing their nose at our parliament, he said. This should be released as a demonstration of the so-called new leaf that you're trying to project. But how do we have any confidence in the things you say that you're doing when we're treated with disrespect? PwC International commissioned the report from law firm Linklaters in May. It found no evidence of PwC personnel outside of Australia misusing confidential information for commercial gain, but that six international partners should have raised concerns as to whether the information was confidential, according to a statement from PwC in September. When Mr. Burrows appeared in front of the committee in October, he admitted no one from PwC Australia was privy to its details. PwC also withheld a report from the TPB and ATO, the regulators warned on Friday. And what to make of the sudden departure of more top female talent from Australia's post-executive team? In the very months after the CEO Paul Graham called in consultants to slice fat across the organisation and slim headcounts in the C-suite, a confluence of events that, if one is to believe Australia Post, is entirely coincidental. But the unavoidable truth is that women, once equal in number to the men in the executive, are back to a vanishing small minority. There's only one left. Cast the mind back to the closing months of 2022, and they were evenly split among the eight-member posse of EGMs. And now, it's an embarrassment of Windsor knots and bad haircuts. It's guys named Mike and Paul and Gary and Rod. Leonie Valentine was the first to disappear from the company website in February 2023, ending her time at Australia Post after a startlingly short 13 months. Valentine had been tasked with leading Australia Post's gender action plan, which at this point looks to have been thrown from a high window. It's getting tougher to keep count of the senior women who've left in her wake. Chief Marketing Officer Amber Collins, General Manager Fiona De Silva, Government Relations Head Sally McKenzie. Now add to that the very quiet departure of Executive General Manager Tanny Mangos. She resigned last month, no word of departure from Australia Post. Mangos, 2 years in the role, flagged her exit on LinkedIn with a fating of CEO Graham, a transformative and fearless leader, and telling everyone she would take time off before her next career move. And suddenly missing from the Australia Post executive team is EGM for Retail, one of the highest paid women in the organisation. She left the business in January after a 2 year stint. Neither was her exit announced by the mail service, as is their way, both exits having left Susan Davies as the last woman standing among the six fellows at the table. It's a terrible loss, and only Mangus's position is vacant, sudden exits like those of Mangus, Noble and Valentine don't bode well for female longevity at the organisation. And weird too, how Valentine and Noble were swiftly replaced by men. Noble's deputy, Josh Bannister, was appointed internally last month, while Valentine's replacement, Michael McNamara, started in July. There's a brief chance to appoint a female CFO, but that was missed when Michael Bradburn was awarded the role starting in November. Need it be pointed out that this is all going down while Australia Post lurches forth, groping into a great modernisation of its business. Services might be lumbering ahead into the 21st century, but female representation is apparently blazing a path all the way back to the 50s. And the reporting season continues. Car Group reported revenue rose 60% to $531 million and adjusted net profit jumped 34% to $162.7 million when compared to the 2023 same half. Electronics and white goods retail JB Hi-Fi posted sales of over $5.16 billion as net profit fell nearly 20% to $264.3 million. Horizon's net interim net profit doubled to $237 million. Oil and gas producer Beach Energy has reported a slip in production and wound back its full-year guidance despite posting higher sales in its latest half-year report. Production for the 6 months came in at 8.8 million barrels, down 11% on 2023's same half. Sales revenue rose 16% to $941 million. Global construction materials giant James Hardie's third-quarter net income jumped 39% to US $179.9 million. Fourth quarter guidance is for net income to be a lower US $165 million, or slightly higher US $185 million. Temple & Webster posted sales of $253.8 million, up 23%, as interim net profit lifted 6% to $4.1 million. Seven West Media interim profit fell to $775 million. From $814 million, down 4.8% in 6 months of December. Its net profit also plunged to $54 million, down from $114 million in the same period in 2022, down 52.6%. And its group EBITDA was $124 million, down from $205 million, down 39.4%. CSL announced revenue of US $8.05 billion for the half year, up 11% on a constant currency basis, while net profit after tax and amortization, the company's preferred measure, was 11% higher at US $2.02 billion. ASX-listed financial services company Challenger has beat analyst expectations, posting a $56 million interim profit, up 80% on the prior corresponding period's $28 million result. Breville, which makes juices, toast, has kettles, has reported a net profit of $83.3 million for the December half, up $6.7 million, as sales lifted 2% to $908.8 million. Seek net profit for the first half, FY24, was $35.2 million, a 74% decline on the same period in the previous year. Adjusted net profit is expected to be $190 to $220 million compared to $220 million to $260 million. Falcon Steel's interim profit has fallen more than 50%, coming in at $26.1 million versus $55.4 million. Commonwealth Bank's cash profit fell 3% in the first half of the financial year to $5 billion. Seven Group's overall earnings before interest and tax climbed 18% for the half year, while statutory net profit dropped 36% to $225 million, and underlying net profit climbed 31% to $474 million. Fletcher Building earnings before interest and tax declined 27% to $264 million, according to its latest half-year results. Car parts maker GUD Holdings revenue increased 8.6% to $492.6 million. Statutory net profit jumped 19.5% to $51.4 million. IDP Education has recorded an increase to its revenue, up 15% to $579 million. Earnings before interest and tax increased 25% to $159 million. Net profit jumped 23% to $170 million. GrainCorp expects to report FY24 underlying EBITDA in the range of $270 million to $310 million, down from $565 million in FY23. Underlying net profit is expected to be in the range of $55 to $95 million, down from $250 million in FY23. Maine's first half revenue climbed 11%, $202.2 million, driven by a rebound in property listings in Sydney and Melbourne, which offset sluggish conditions in the other cities. Profit was up 48.7% to $25.8 million. Downer posted a net profit of $72.1 million, up 5.9%, with revenue in the first half came in at $6 billion, down 1.9%. The company posted a heavy loss of $385.7 million for FY23 due to write-downs in its acquisition of Spotless. Financial services group AMP has posted a 32% fall in full-year profit to $265 million. 360 Capital's values of its investment will likely result in an unaudited statutory loss of $5.4 million. Real estate group Dexus recorded a statutory net loss after tax for the half year of $597.2 million compared to a statutory net profit after tax of $23.1 million a year ago. Computershare's half-year net profit slumped 40.6% to US$105.2 million. That's 162 million Aussie. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Matt Vitale, co-founder and CEO of Birchall, Australia's leading equity crowdsource funding platform. Matt is passionate about democratising access to capital for Australian startups and as a disruptor in equity funding. And I'll be talking to Indeed economist Callum Pickering about the latest unemployment figures. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, you catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongettler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week and looking forward to bringing Talking Business next week.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.